So this week I'm going to talk about what you might call a more meat and potatoes Buddhism kind of topic. I'm going to talk about the Four Noble Truths. And I guess the first thing I'll say about these, in my experience, these are very deep truths about life. And I think everyone has a relationship to them, whether they know the verbal formulation or not. I don't really think of these as in any way contradicting the teachings of any other religion. And that's kind of what interests me. What sort of relationship do we have with these deep truths of life? And what does that say about who we are, you know? And so very briefly, just a brief statement of them. The first noble truth, you could say something like, life is, the technical statement, life is dukkha. You could say life is discomfort or unsatisfying. You know, and very specifically, it's unenlightened life is not particularly satisfying. The second noble truth is that the cause of this dukkha, the cause of this unsatisfactoriness, is clinging, attachment, grabbing onto things. The third noble truth is that it's possible to get out of this mess and attain this state nirvana. And the fourth noble truth is the how-to, essentially. How do we get to nirvana? By following the Noble Eightfold Path. So that's a very brief overview. And I think actually I'll start with the third noble truth and this curious idea of nirvana. And before we can even talk about what nirvana is, we have to talk about what it's not. It's, we're all mammals. And so it's very natural that we have fantasies about being in this like warm, cozy place, you know, emotionally, physically, having this coziness, comfort, you know, lots of joy, lots of hope, not a whole lot of pain or fear. That would be the ideal for the mammalian body, for the mammalian brain. And that's not really what nirvana is. Nirvana is not an escape in any way. Nirvana is not an anesthesia for the pain of life. Nirvana is not a guarantee that we will never feel pain. In fact, it's part of the Buddhist teaching, and it's kind of just a fact of life. It's sort of obvious that life is a mix of pleasure and pain. That's just what life is. And nirvana is in no way escaping that. You might say that nirvana is a heroic, open-hearted yes to everything that life is. One way to say it is that if I'm in states of mind such as hope, excitement, enthusiasm, exuberance, there's a lot of vital energy in those emotional states. And those are very fun states to be in. Now, if I'm in states of anger, rage, despair, guilt, shame, depression, those are not so fun, but there's still vital energy in them. There's a tremendous vital energy in all those states. And to some extent, nirvana is a saying yes to the vitality of experience, whatever the quality of that experience is. And it's almost paradoxical, you know, from our current state of life, it's almost paradoxical. Why would we want that, you know? And it's one of the, it's in many ways one of the great paradoxes of Buddhism. That in fact this open-hearted yes to life is a much more satisfying, fulfilling place than the game that we usually play of trying to keep ourselves safe. So I'll circle back to nirvana a bit, but now we'll go to the first and second truths. The first truth, sometimes the word dukkha is translated just as suffering, and then it sounds like what Buddha's, you know, the first noble truth is life as suffering. And what I don't like about that is that for people who don't know a whole lot about Buddhism, it sounds like it's saying that you know, Buddhism is saying that life isn't a particularly good thing, you know? And there's kind of a tendency, especially with our American puritanical kind of viewpoint, to think of life as this not very good thing, you know? In fact, Buddhism is saying life is more wonderful than you can possibly imagine. And if we could just get out of our own way, we'd experience this joy all the time, you know? And so dukkha is a very technical word. It doesn't really mean suffering. It's hard to translate in any one way. It refers to the fact that life is this mixture of pleasure and pain. That's what life is. It's a mixture of pleasure and pain. And we're not at peace with that. That instead of accepting life as it is, we concoct all these elaborate strategies to try and maximize the pleasure and try and avoid the pain. You know, and we have all these fantasies that somehow we can be very clever and outsmart the pain of life. And of course, we can't. To be human is to be profoundly vulnerable. And so the First Noble Truth is very much about the dissatisfaction we have from not being aligned with what life is. You know, when our fantasies, when our picture of the world is not aligned with the simple truth of how life is, we're dissatisfied, because the only satisfaction comes from aligning with what life is. And the Second Noble Truth says that the cause of this whole predicament is grasping, clinging. And so one thing that the Second Noble Truth says, it's kind of implicit in the Second Noble Truth, is that the mess of our life is our own problem. You know, we think we have conflicts with others. We don't. Our real conflict is always with ourselves. We think we have issues with others. We don't. All our issues are really with ourselves. You know, on and on again. Everything about where we are is, everything about where I am is my responsibility. Everything about where you are is your responsibility. This is implicit in the Second Noble Truth. And so before I go on, I'll talk a little bit. Those first two truths are very powerful, and people have all kinds of relationships to them. You know, there are some people who, you might say, walk around with a chip on their shoulder about the First Noble Truth, you know? They resent the fact that they have to suffer. Like, why should I suffer? You know, I mean, they're suffering all over the place, but why should I have to suffer, you know? And it's almost this personal thing. Like, doesn't life know that I deserve not to suffer? You know? And of course, when you're in that place, you know, and typically people are in that place, they're so overwhelmed with their own stuff that they're not able to track other people that well. And then, of course, it's this bad cycle, because if I'm not tracking other people that well, then chances are I might be saying things or doing things that would offend other people, and then they're getting mad at me, and then it's even, oh, why are all these people getting mad at me, you know? I already have it hard, you know, this sort of thing. My mother told me this great story. When she turned 65, the insurance called her and said, you know, they recommended this defensive driving class for seniors, and, you know, she'd get a discount on her insurance if she took it, this sort of thing. So she went to this class. It was designed for senior citizens, and sounded like the instructor was very good. And he just started the whole conversation with, what are some things that you see that other drivers doing that bother you? And, you know, people are talking about the normal things, you know, people pulling out and going slow in front of you or not using their directionals or things like this. And one woman says, well, what I don't like is everybody's always honking at me. And so, how can I say this? It's very easy to caricature that type, the type that just always resents the fact that life is suffering. But I think the truth is, we all have a little bit of that, you know? And it's really, you know, in a moment when we are really triggered, in a moment that we're really tweaked, we're probably in a place where we're not doing a very good job of tracking everyone else or being fair to everyone else or that sort of thing, you know? And so it's a very humbling thing to think about that. You know, many of the times when we're most triggered, what is actually triggered is a place from early childhood. And a place from early childhood that's been wounded is probably still infantile. And so some of our infantile behaviors come out in that moment, you know? And it is a very infantile place to be in that place of, you know, only I matter and, you know, my suffering is everything and your suffering doesn't matter, like that kind of thing, you know? And for the second noble truth, is predicated on a tremendous amount of self-responsibility. And there's all kinds of ways that people say no to responsibility in life. They don't want to take responsibility for themselves. They want to give their power away. You know, think of all the victim narratives. Think of, you know, cycles of blame, you know. So-and-so did that to me, you know. It's his fault that I feel that way because of what he did, you know. That kind of thing. It's a very, very hard thing and a humbling thing to take responsibility for everything in your life. Now, in the second noble truth, it talks about the cause of our predicament is clinging. And I would say there's what I would call three different kinds of clinging. There's what I would call intellectual distraction, mental distraction. There's cycles of addiction. And then there's fear and defense patterns. And neurobiologically, they're very separate kinds of systems. Mental distraction is simply when we're up in our head. We cause a lot of our problems because we're in our head rather than in our vitality. And we live in a culture that places tremendous value in being in our head. And it places tremendous value on avoiding vulnerability. You know? If I'm in my head, I can more or less kind of control what I think, you know? If I'm down in my feelings, I can't really control what I'm feeling, you know? So it's scarier. To feel deeply is much more vulnerable. There's no vulnerability really in thinking. And so that one is more driven just by habit, just by getting into the habit of going up in the head and staying there rather than dropping more into the body, into the vitality, into the vulnerability. Some of the grasping that Buddhism talks about is grasping after pleasure. And so this is what I would call cycles of addiction. And I think we all kind of know, like, the bigger ticket, you know, popularly recognized addictions. There's drugs, there's alcohol, there's cigarettes, this sort of thing. And I'm going to assume that no one here is, like, on heroin or crack or something like that, you know. But the astonishing thing about an addiction, what an addiction does to the mammalian mind, is it makes the mammalian mind think that it's free. It makes the mammalian mind think, I'm choosing this freely. I could quit at any time, you know? And that's a very common story. We've heard this all the time. Like the person who drinks gallons a day will say, oh, I could quit any time. They're under the illusion that it's not a problem. That's part and parcel of the thought cycle of addiction, you know? And it's almost cliche in alcohol treatment. You know, the first step is to admit that you have a problem. It actually takes a tremendous shift in consciousness to acknowledge, you know, to see through that mental game, which the mind is just running because it's so hooked on the pleasure, to see through that and say, oh, wait, I really do have a problem. That's huge. But of course, no other work can happen until you have that realization. And so the question is, the very interesting question is, even if we're not addicted to, you know, these more, you know, these chemical things, you know, the things that normally, you know, we think about when we hear the word addiction, what are we addicted to? Because the tricky thing is that anything that I'm addicted to, I'm going to think it's free. I'm going to think, you know, I'm choosing this freely. I could stop it at any time. I have no problem with this, you know. You know, is it something like attention or approval? Is it, you know, is it some kind of emotional thing? Is it some kind of, you know, something that we eat or something, you know? It's just worth noticing. And the two ways that it shows up, if it's something that we get all the time, and then suddenly circumstances arise and we can't get it, and we're really tweaked, that might suggest that there's a problem. And also feedback from friends is really good on this. Like, gee, that's really important to you, Mike. Like, what's going on with that, you know? The funny thing is that we're all kind of screwed up, but we're screwed up in different ways, so we can give good feedback to each other, you know? The last kind of clinging is patterns of defense. And this shows up both in what Buddhism calls aversion, and it also shows up in indifference. Indifference is just kind of a numbing out of feeling. You know, for whatever reason, it hurts too much to dive into feelings on a certain subject, so I'm just going to numb myself out. So I'm going to be indifferent. I don't care at all, you know. But that doesn't mean I'm feeling nothing. It means that there's a lot that I'm afraid to feel. Now, if you think of what happens with the physical body, if I receive a physical injury, of course, what happens is I tighten up. And part of that is protective. You know, if it's a fresh physical injury, I need to protect it a little bit. But then the problem would be is I'm walking through the rest of life tighten that way, my body would be compromised, you know? And essentially, that's what happens with our emotional body, that we get wounded and we tighten up. And of course, it's perfectly natural when a wound is fresh that you'd be a little tight and that it would take time to process and heal it. But sometimes we walk around for years kind of tightened up around issues. You know, it might even be from early childhood. We got tightened up and then we just never relaxed. It's this tremendously rich teaching in Buddhism that I'm sure you've heard before, that anyone who upsets you, anyone who offends you, is your teacher. You know, and the idea is that, you know, no one can really make you upset. Your emotions are yours, you know? And so someone says blah, 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 and then it triggers you. Well, they're showing you where a trigger is inside of you. You know? That's something for you to work on. You know, they have no responsibility for that. They were just, you know, the issue really is the trigger I have. Now, the third noble truth, we talked a little about this, nirvana. It's very interesting to think about, what do we think is our goal? What do we think is our goal in life? What do we think is the goal of our spiritual work? What do we imagine as our goal? know? And is it something, are we chasing something or pursuing something that is deeply consistent with what life is? Or are we pursuing something that's kind of a fantasy that has no connection to the way life really is, you know? And again, Nirvana is about almost this rigorous acceptance of life exactly as it is. Now, the fourth noble truth, I'm not going to talk too much about the Eightfold Noble Path now. In fact, I may talk about that next week. I'll just say, you know, in as far as Buddhism is concerned, well, how do we get to Nirvana? Well, it's the Eightfold Noble Path, but it's just the sum of Buddhist teachings in general, you know. And of course, we could spend lots of time talking about all the philosophy of Buddhism and what's the most important and all that. But really what it comes down to is we all know what we have to do next, you know. We all really know what are the things that are most urgent to change in our lives or what are the improvements that are most urgent. And often it's exactly the thing that it's so vulnerable I don't want to look at it, but that's where I need to start working. You know, and so rather than, I think it's very easy with this question of where do we begin our spiritual path, it's very easy to get lost in philosophy and what's the nature, you know, all kinds of speculation, that sort of thing. And I think it's much more important to be very grounded and very practical. You know, in your life right now, in your core, what needs to shift? What needs to grow? You know, and it if it doesn't feel vulnerable and confronting, you probably haven't struck on the thing that is most at your edge. So with that, I'll hand out the quote sheet. I always have a quote sheet. And I might have to ask a couple people to share. I wasn't expecting such a full room today. So I have brief statements of the Four Noble Truths at the top, and I have this passage from Walt Whitman. This is from I Sing the Body Electric by Walt Whitman. I love this passage. I have perceived that to be with those I like is enough. To stop in company with the rest at evening is enough. To be surrounded by beautiful, curious, breathing, laughing flesh is enough. To pass among them or touch any one of them, to rest my arm ever so lightly round his or her neck for a moment. What is this then? I do not ask any more delight. I swim in it as a sea. There is something in staying close to men and women and looking on them and in the contact and odor of them that pleases the soul well. All things please the soul, but these please the soul well. You know, this is a guy who just loved people, you know, got excited about people. And there's something of the nature of Nirvana about that. Just accepting, like if you can accept everyone as they show up, that's pretty close to accepting life as it is, you know. So from Laura's Ingalls Wilder, suffering passes while love is eternal. That's a gift you have received from God. Don't waste it. Very practical. From Marcel Proust, the novelist, we are healed from suffering only by experiencing it to the full. And again, the paradox of healing. We don't get healing by walking away from pain. We get healing by going deeper into the pain and experiencing it fully. From that remarkable woman, Helen Keller, character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, ambition inspired, and success achieved. The poet Khalil Gibran says, out of suffering have emerged the strongest souls. The most massive characters are seared with scars. The sage Paramahamsa Yogananda says, This life is not man's own show. If he becomes personally and emotionally involved in the very complicated cosmic drama, he reaps inevitable suffering for having distorted the divine plot. You know? Maybe a shorter way to say that is, life has a life of its own. It doesn't care about our fantasies. The concentration camp survivor Viktor Frankl says, if there is a meaning in life at all, then there must be a meaning in suffering. Suffering is an radical part of life, even as fate and death. Without suffering and death, human life cannot be complete. This is a man who saw lots of suffering during his years in Auschwitz. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross says, the most beautiful people we have known are those who have known defeat, known suffering, known struggle, known loss, and have found their way out of those depths. Louise Hay says, all is well. Everything is working out for my highest good. Out of this situation, only good will come. I am safe. It will work miracles in your life. Thich Nhat Hanh says, we have the tendency to run away from suffering and look for happiness, but in fact, if you have not suffered, you have no chance to experience real happiness. The current Dalai Lama says, too much self-centered attitude, you see, brings, you see, isolation. Result, loneliness, fear, anger. The extreme self-centered attitude is a source of suffering. This one I included. This is a lyric from a Beatles song called Savoy Truffle. It was actually written by George Harrison. It's actually a brilliant song about addiction and the concept of grasping. So this is just a few lines. You might feel it now, but when the pain cuts through, you're going to know and how. The sweat is going to fill your head. When it becomes too much, you shout out loud. And then a little later, you know what you eat, you are, but what is sweet now turns sour. We all know oh blah dee blah da, but can you show me where you are? And just this whole idea, when we lose ourselves in pleasure, we lose where we are. We lose who we are because we get swept away by the pleasure. John Kabat-Zinn says, all the suffering, stress, and addiction comes from not realizing you are already what you are looking for. Very simple. Karen Armstrong says, all religions are designed to teach us how to live joyfully, serenely, and kindly in the midst of suffering. I love this one from Bob Marley. Truth is, everyone's going to hurt you. You just got to find the ones worth suffering for. That's great dating advice also. Jack Kornfield says, to bow to the fact of our life's sorrows and betrayals is to accept them. From this deep gesture, we discover that all of life is workable. As we learn to bow, we discover that the heart holds more freedom and compassion than we could imagine. I like that one a lot. Eckhart Tolle, very wise man, says, thoughts are fine when you don't confuse them with who you are. Then thoughts are not a problem. Thinking is a wonderful tool to create things in this world. It only becomes problematic and a source of suffering when you confuse thinking with who you are. That's big. The very wise man Don Miguel Ruiz, talking about one of the so-called four agreements. Don't take anything personally. Nothing others do is because of you. What you say and do, what others say and do is a projection of their own reality, their own dreams. You are immune to the opinions and actions of others. You won't be the victim of needless suffering. From Dr. Charles Glassman, he says, I will always find a way, and a way will always find me. I like that in connection to the Eightfold Noble Path. Daniel Hansen says, you're only as weak as you let yourself become, and you're only as strong as you allow yourself to be. Again, the tremendous self-responsibility in that line. And Alicia, I've never heard of her, but she says, Never fear love's absence in your life, because it already exists within you in great abundance.